Representative Cameron, whose district we were supposed to be in, and along with Senator Winter's district. Representative Glazier, would you like to join us at the dais?
Yes.
All right. In the Ways and Means process, a lot of times we get siloed so that things like prisons and Department of Justice and district attorneys and public defense services are public safety issues. But I wanted to broaden the debate on what true public safety is. And in my view, it's not just about building prisons. It's also about early childhood interventions. It's about services to domestic violence survivors. It's about better funding for drug and alcohol treatment, mental health services, proper funding of state troopers and district attorneys. And that's why we convene this informational hearing today to broaden that debate. I'd like to also thank Senator Winters and Representative Cameron and their staff for the work that they put in to try to have this at Almsville Elementary to really showcase what the great work that, and their commitment to Head Start in their own particular districts. And I'd like to now hand it off to Representative Cameron to see if he'd like to make any introductory comments that he might have made had we been able to have this at the elementary school in his district.
Thank you, Chair Shields, and I apologize for us having to move things at the last minute, but I guess that happens a lot around here, and feels like it's end times day today. I just want to thank everybody for coming and to really express an understanding that I have that public safety is a far-reaching responsibility that we have, but I also understand that the safest unit that we should have in our state is the family. And if children are not safe in their families and with their parents, then we're going to fail. And I understand that the observations that I've made here in Marion County and with the groups that have been put together that really have stepped up to the plate and leveraged the state resources that are provided sometimes with volunteer organizations and with volunteer or private dollars, it's amazing to me to see what's been done in Marion County with those types of things. And I just think it's a real honor to be able to have a public hearing, a state public hearing here in our local area. It's not just my district, but several districts around here that are represented, and Senator Winters as well would probably agree with that, with the great things that are done in Marion County by many people who pull their resources together to help families and our young children understand what their first exposure to public safety is, and that's when they're very young. And I think if we continue to focus on that here in our community as individuals in our own families, but also when there's young ones that need that help, we will have a stronger society many years from now as a result of that. And I thank you for allowing me to express that today.
Well said, Representative. Senator Winters, would you like to make some comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for agreeing to host this. And I'm sorry you had to come from Almsville to the Capitol, and I thank Representative Cameron. And I'm not going to be able to stay with you throughout your public testimony. As most of you know, that I'm recovering from some major surgery. And Doc Bates told me that I started early this morning and that I need to probably go home. But I do want to thank particularly the law enforcement community here in Marion County, who, when they heard the call, that they responded, that their job was more than just to apprehend and to lock up, but they recognize that there is a correlation between how we develop programs for families, and that there is a nexus between whether or not we have a Head Start or whether we have other services in this community. And they probably have been one of the biggest champions in Marion County to make certain that we are focusing on children and families. And I need to say that because Walt Biglow and Jim Myers and the chief from Turner all here, and they're all a part of a strike force that we put together in this county to not only get tough on crime, but to also make certain we're putting families back together. And one who's been in this building for a long time, and I have been here a long time, I thoroughly support Head Start. I'm committed, and you need to know that, both from the standpoint of the program, but the investment that this building needs to make certain that we are doing early childhood. We're not even at where we need to be in early childhood, as far as I'm concerned. So just know that I do support the effort, and I do support funding Head Start, and I thank all of you for being here. And with that, Dr. Bates will probably tell me that I need to get up from this dais and go home.
Thank you, Senator.
If I don't, Wes Flynn will tell me.
Thank you, Senator Winters.
I was timing her.
Why don't we go ahead and get started? Ms. Burnham, would you please come forward? And I understand you have one other who would like to testify with you.
Yes, I do. Thank you very much for hearing us this evening. My name is Jody Burnham. I'm the director for Head Start of Marion Polk County, and I'd like to introduce to you Corey Bruin. And Corey Bruin is a parent in our program and has four sons, and so she'll tell you a little bit about her experience as well. What I'd like to tell you is just a little bit about Head Start in Marion County. I'm at the Community Action Agency, but there are two other programs. There's Salem-Kaiser Head Start that's done through the school district, and there's also OCDC, which is the Oregon Coalition that serves migrant and seasonal Head Start children as well. And between the three of our programs, we serve about 1,000 children every day in our programs here in Marion County. And one of the points is that we are only serving 43% of the children who are eligible in Marion County because of funding, and Marion County is the lowest served in the state of Oregon, and we're right here in the capital, so we're very visible. There was a recent survey that the kindergarten teachers did, and they pointed out three things that they felt were the lowest lacking in kindergarten children, and that's dental care, nutrition, and also social-emotional, just being able to get along with other children. And three of the things that we do in Head Start is that we work with kids on dental, nutrition, and, of course, the social-emotional. And in the survey that the kindergarten folks did, what they were kindergarten teachers, they said that, you know, having a good preschool experience and Head Start really prepared children for learning in kindergarten. And, you know, they can see them coming in the door and know that the kids are ready to learn. They know how to sit in a circle. They know how to play with their friends. They know how to negotiate between themselves if they want something, and they know how to ask for that, and they also can be patient. So those kinds of things are imperative to learning, especially when you get into the primary grades. The other thing that they were asked was how many of them felt that a preschool experience for children was essential and necessary, and all of them said yes, that they felt every child in Oregon should have some preschool experience prior to entering kindergarten to at least get those kinds of skills. In Head Start, we don't look at just the child that's coming through the door. We're not all about reading, writing, and arithmetic. We do spend a lot of time on health, nutrition. We serve 2/3 of a child's nutrition per day. So when a child comes to Head Start, they've got good food, and it's, like I said, it's 2/3 of their nutrition per day when they come into a Head Start classroom. They also get disabilities and mental health screening, and then referrals if necessary, and then even in our programs we provide that in the classrooms so that when children are in the classrooms they get that kind of care, and specialists come in, and if we can't provide that type of help, especially with maybe some mental health issues, we know who we can refer to, and Head Start funds do help pay for that if the Oregon if they're not on OHP. We also work with children with disabilities. 10% of our children are children that have disabilities, and they're, you know, far-ranging disabilities, from speech and language to behavioral and everything in between. And we also work with 13% of the children in our particular program here in Marion County have either one or both spouse or one or both parents who have been incarcerated or are incarcerated at the time. And so we actually have family educators that work with those families on those types of issues. And we have some parenting classes around that, and we have a good relationship with the children of incarcerated parents. We go to those meetings every, now they're quarterly, and are assisted by that group as far as helping our kids deal with what that must be like for them in their homes. And just recently we have at two of our sites, we now have a deputy sheriff that's coming and reading to our kids in full uniform, which makes a huge difference to our children. A lot of our kids have seen police officers. Unfortunately, they're usually hiring someone from their home away. So by seeing them come into our classrooms, interacting with our children, has made a huge difference. We had one child who, we were there, they brought the police car, and they let the kids walk through the back of the sheriff car, actually. And this child was just, she literally freaked out. And she said, no, they'll take me away like they did my dad. And so now she's very friendly with the police officer, or the sheriff that comes in and reads to her. And she's feeling very comfortable about her relationship with them. And it's a good thing, not a bad thing in her eyes any longer. What I'd like to do now is, if you don't have any questions, I'd like to turn it over to Corey so she can talk a little bit about her experience as a parent in the Head Start program.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Byrne.
Thank you. First of all, thank you so much for letting me come here and talk, not just for myself, but on behalf of other parents. I'm just one example, and even just being in Head Start, I've met so many people that have moved from situations where you can't even believe the circumstances to just amazing empowerment and self-empowerment to actually move out of those situations and do something that's really important and much better for their family. I do have four children. I have four little boys who are 2, 5, 7, and 9. My oldest did not attend Head Start. I had help, and he was able to go to a private preschool. However, my 7-year-old and my 5-year-old now, they have both either attended Head Start or been in Head Start. And it has been, wow, an amazing journey. It's only been 3 years. My 7-year-old spent 1 year in Head Start. My 5-year-old has been in Head Start for 2 years now. When I started, I didn't really know what Head Start was. I worked in various daycares. I worked at the YMCA, Learning Tree, stuff like that. I worked with young kids, and I didn't trust anyone with my kids. And I didn't know what Head Start was, didn't plan on having my kids go to Head Start. I grew up with the assumption that it was the short yellow bus for just disabled children and stuff. I know that's, like, totally dumb, but that's how we grew up. Anyway, the way that I got involved with Head Start is my 7-year-old started going through this phase where, like, just out of nowhere, where he hated himself, he hated everyone around him, his behavior was starting to change, he had massive mood swings, he'd sleep for long amounts of time, he had huge behavioral outbursts, he couldn't make friends, he was starting to fall down a certain path, and it was starting to, like, really concern me. So I took him to the doctors, and the doctors recommended, among other things, that I seek out early intervention and have him just kind of have someone talk to him and see if he was, you know, emotionally what he was going through. Eventually, early intervention pointed me towards Head Start, and I decided to put him into Head Start. Again, to remind you how he was before he went into Head Start, he was literally talking about killing himself. He wanted to hurt everyone around him. He didn't think anybody loved him. He wasn't speaking very much. I mean, other than negative things, he had some other behavioral issues. Like, he was, like, pretty old, and he was going back and not being potty trained and all that. But he got into Head Start. Within months, he had friends. He was learning how to control his behavior. He was a completely different child. And the biggest thing that really helped him was what they did for our family. Like I said, when I put him in Head Start, I didn't want to. I didn't trust anyone. I decided if I was going to put my kids with anyone else but me, I was going to be super involved. And since then, I have had the opportunity to be involved. I currently serve as my third year as chair on policy council. I'm on the Community Action Agency board. I've been able to participate on hiring committees. I've been able to participate in ways that I never imagined that I could. And it's really empowered me to go from a single mother out of a situation of abuse and with, you know, children that I didn't know what I was going to do raising them by myself, and now I'm empowered for the future to take care of my children. I think my biggest thing is that, in my opinion, it all really boils down to whenever you're going to take care of something, it's better to be prepared than have to do a bunch of intervention and cleanup later. It's the same thing with our health. You know, our doctors tell us to take care of ourselves and to, you know, take vitamins or exercise or whatever, you know, our doctors tell us to do to keep healthy. It's the same thing with our children. I think that an ounce of prevention is worth years and years and years of intervention, and nobody can tell me any different. And I've seen it in my own family. I've seen it in the children that I watch in my daycare versus the children that have gone to Head Start in my family. So if you guys let me, I'd go on and on and on. There's so much I want to say that I end up not usually saying at all, but the point is that I can't tell you how much I truly believe and how much I've experienced that Head Start can do so much to lift someone out from where they are and put them somewhere else and prepare them for future involvement in their kids' lives, which does keep them all safer and happier. So.
Very well said. Any questions? Great. Well, thank you very much for coming forward. You did a very nice job. We really appreciate it. You are truly right. An ounce of prevention is worth years and years of cure. Next up is, the panel, Mr. Darker from the Children's Institute, Maggie Miller from the Citizens Crime Commission, and Lynn Lundquist from the Oregon Business Coalition. Welcome to the committee. We're ready. Whoever would like to go first.
Thank you very much for allowing us to speak with you this evening. I'm Swatia Darkar, the Executive Director of the Children's Institute, and with me here today are Maggie Miller from Citizens Crime Commission and Lynn Lundquist from Oregon Business Association, but we are all together part of the Ready for School Coalition, and we'd be happy to each talk about why this issue is important to us, and you can feel free to ask us questions at the end or individually. I don't know how you'd like to proceed.
Why don't you go all the way through, and then we'll ask questions at the end.
Okay, super. I just wanted to share a little bit about why the Children's Institute was created. It's a fairly new organization, and really it was created by a group of folks who are business and philanthropic leaders to look at the research on what the most cost-effective investments are in terms of making sure at-risk children arrive at school healthy and ready for school, ready to succeed. As we know, if kids come to school prepared, they're much more likely to stay in school, succeed, and graduate, which, as you know, has profound implications for cost savings around crime, lost earnings, and many other kinds of issues. The Children's Institute, for more than 2 years, did really deep research looking at national research, state and local research, interviewing national experts and local experts as to what were the most cost-effective interventions. And it's amazing the confluence of agreement, the folks who have come to the clear understanding that investing in high-quality early childhood education for at-risk kids delivers dividends again and again and again. So the choir has Nobel laureate economists like James Heckman. You have, you know, economists from the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, neuroscientists, and it's rare to have so many different experts from various disciplines all urging the same investment. And, you know, 20 years ago, we knew about Head Start, and it, you know, it made sense to us. It just seemed like common sense, like the old adage of an ounce of prevention. But in fact, we now have the hard evidence behind it. We know in the last 20 years a lot more about the developing brain. And we know that by the time a child arrives at kindergarten, 90% of the brain is already developed. And that window to shape and nurture that potential has been lost if you start in kindergarten. Particularly, we know at-risk kids are more likely to start school behind and stay behind. So what the research is pointing us to is the problem that our public investments start most seriously at the time of kindergarten and increase as a child ages, the opposite trajectory to where we can have the greatest impact. When we looked at the most promising strategy, according to the research, for closing the achievement gap, for reducing crime, for preventing child abuse, or school readiness, it all points to the same strategy, which is providing high-quality early childhood education to at-risk kids and involving parents. That's exactly what our Head Start program does. And we know from our own evaluations here, according to the Galileo assessment, that our Head Start program is having dramatic results. Unfortunately, we still have thousands of kids on the waiting list. And as our business leader, Dick Withnell, likes to say, those are kids who aren't on a waiting list. They're on an unserved list because they're going to come to kindergarten not prepared. And we have an opportunity now. In 1988, the Oregon legislature, in a very forward-looking direction, set a goal for itself to fully fund the Head Start program. And while we've made some increases along the way, we've lost ground nationally, and a lot of states have really stepped up to the plate around this issue. We have an opportunity to look at fully funding the Head Start program and allowing all those eligible kids waiting for Head Start to be served. And that's what the Ready for School Coalition is about. It is a group of high-level business and civic leaders who've taken time out of their otherwise busy schedules to make this a priority. And Dick Alexander is the chair of this effort, and this is the very first Ready for School opportunity that I have not seen him at. I can tell you he's been tirelessly here at the Capitol along with my other colleagues. And the reason they care about this issue is because it is a workforce issue too. Mm-hmm. People are worried about having an educated and skilled workforce. Just to sort of highlight some of the public safety implications, to give you a sense that not only is this good a good strategy from an economic standpoint, but on the public safety side. I'm sure some of you are familiar with the gold standard study looking at providing high-quality early childhood to low-income kids in Michigan, in Ypsilanti, Michigan, for the Perry Preschool Study. Those children were followed for 40 years, and what they found are astronomical savings due to crime prevention. And so whether it's the Perry Preschool, whether it's the Chicago Parent Child Center study, or the study done by our research director, David Mendel, looking at Oregon's OPK program, we know that the savings from crime are so significant that it pays for the program more than twice over in the most conservative estimate. So there's no question here as to does this program pay for itself and more, whether you're talking about the most conservative to the most, the broadest cost-saving estimates we know, which are Perry Preschool, which is for every $1 invested, a $17 savings. What I was hoping to be able to share with you today was not just why Oregon, not only why this is important from the standpoint of public safety, but economic benefits as well. I mean, we know that when kids come to school prepared, they're much more likely to hit that third grade reading benchmark, which we know tells us they're more likely to graduate. The next step is they're more likely to have increased earnings. As we know, there's a connection between that, again, and public safety, whether they're more likely to be on the contributing to taxes versus in the prison system. So I welcome your questions and applaud your interest in this whole issue, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Ms. Miller.
Yes, hi. Hello, I'm Chair Shields, members of the committee. I'm Maggie Miller, Executive Director of the Citizens Crime Commission in Portland, Oregon. We were established in 1988, almost 20 years ago, the Citizens Crime Commission was. And what it's a group of business leaders in the city of Portland, and it's a nonprofit. And what they do, their mission is to make Oregon state and local public safety system more efficient, cost-effective, and accountable. And at our retreat last August, the number one goal for the Citizens Crime Commission is to get fully funding for pre-K Head Start. And now we've taken a little bit of criticism for that because they were, I think people thought that we were soft on crime because we support best practices and prevention programs. And where we see it goes along with our mission is as far as being effective and cost-efficient and accountable in dealing with crime problems. When we were founded in 1988, what we did is we were founded because of the rising crime problems in Portland. In 1988, the crime rates were skyrocketing. We didn't have enough jail beds, enough police officers, and Representative Barker, you might remember those days.
Mm-hmm.
We advocated with the Association of Portland Progress for the building of Inverness Jail. And also we advocated for two police officers for every 1,000. And what we did is we saw that through the increased spending on the public safety system, crime rates were coming down, but also was an incredible investment of cash into the public safety system. So as part of our mission, we questioned, were there ever more cost-effective ways to fight crime and protect citizens? And you may know in Multnomah County right now, a jail bed is $152 a day in Multnomah County, which would be a nice hotel room on a vacation. Also, the juvenile detention beds can cost up to almost $400 a day when there's treatment services provided. Also, talking about Mr. James Heckman, I have his article here where he states that the estimated net cost of crime in American society, this is 2006, is $1.3 trillion per year, 4.818 per capita. So as part of our mission, we had to find a way not only to pour cash into a criminal justice system that's ever expanding, but how to bring that in and rein that investment in. To this end, our membership formed the Children's Delinquency Prevention Committee to study which interventions work best with children destined to enter the criminal justice system by the time they became adolescents. So we focused our program, on programs having the highest success rate measured against their cost. That study was started in 2000. No, the study was published in 2000, was over a year in undertaking. That study became the Kids Report that eventually became Governor's Kids Hopper's basis for his Oregon's Children's Plan, and was going to be funded for all sorts of different wonderful preventive programs, and then there's something called the .com dash or something like that. So that didn't come about. But the goals of the Kids Report was to reduce the number of children destined to eventually end up in the criminal justice system and also reduce victimization, which is just as important. And to keep children in school, which helps reduce criminal behavior and optimize long-term earning power, and also to break that familial cycle of antisocial behavior, delinquency, and poverty. And the conclusions from that study for the best way to reach our goals was to establish a seamless development continuum that follows and supports at-risk children through preschool years. Often public service agency provide funds during the interventions with children and families who are in the middle of a crisis. However, many of those programs are crisis-oriented and only come into play when the child or family is already in trouble. Few resources focus on positive long-term outcomes for the well-being of children or their families, and even are fewer on crime prevention. And the third conclusion is to teach all children essential skills to read to the best of their ability by the end of grade 3. Because of the Kids Report, the Citizens Crime Commission expanded its mission to support best practices when dealing with prevention and intervention programs as a cost-effective way to fight crime and reduce future rise in crime rates. While the Crime Commission will continue to work with government leaders to find the most effective and efficient ways to fund a balanced public safety system, including district attorneys, defense attorneys, treatment options, and jail beds, the early intervention piece cannot be ignored. We feel as one of the most effective tools to combat the cost of expanding prison system. As been said many, many times, we can't build ourselves out of this problem. For that reason, the Crime Commission strongly supports full funding of the pre-K Head Start for eligible children in Oregon. So I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Miller. Lynn.
Thank you, Chair Shield and committee members. I'm Ben Lundquist, President of the Oregon Business Association. First of all, I apologize for being here instead of Dick Wismel and Dick Alexander. They're the ones who have really carried the heavy load. I'm sure they've been in many of your offices over time. So I'm sort of here.
Who is that?
Maybe it's okay that they're not here. But that's because they have the passion for what we consider a great investment in Oregon in Head Start. I am here tonight because the Oregon Business Association wants to make their voice as part of the business community say this is not an opportunity as much as it is, it's a requirement. It's absolutely essential that we fund Head Start to the level that is appropriate. You've already heard from the prior speakers. The one thing I'd like to drill into your memory tonight is the word investment. It is absolutely essential. When I talked to a gentleman from Minnesota, they did the study back there, and the investment that they make, we talked about the $1 to $17 return. And this is the Public Safety Subcommittee. It wasn't about, the largest saving was not in regard to added income and taxes paid. It was in regard to what didn't happen into the system. That's where the real cost is. And so from a business community, I suppose we could be here on a selfish venue, simply saying that we make that investment, it saves us tax dollars in the end. And that's true. But in addition to that, it's the right thing to do to create the citizens. And earlier there was some comment about the fact that it's not just about reading and math and that sort of thing. It's a total quality of citizens. And so they must have the appropriate start. Mr. Chairman, I know that you are very concerned with the public safety system, how in some cases it's not as efficient as it should be, how we perhaps sometimes lock people up when there are other ways that we all let them out on other venues and so forth. And frankly, we haven't been too successful yet so far in making that a reality because it's very, very difficult. And I applaud you for doing that. But this is an opportunity to go even beyond that, and that don't let them in the system or don't have them in the system in the first place. That's what this is all about. So it's a long-term investment at a very early childhood age that the business community feels is absolutely essential for the betterment of this state. I'll just close by saying this. The Oregon Business Association is not here at the legislature day after day to promote the bottom line, to try to promote those policies that create a better bottom line for the business community directly. We are here to promote the type of Oregon that will allow the environment, the business environment, to be such that we can have a successful business, which will create the dollars. There's a difference in how you come about that. And so with that, just a closing remark, I applaud you for listening to this. The chair of the Education Committee is here, and I know it's a great challenge to allocate these dollars through the many avenues and very requests that you have. I guess I'll close by saying this. I was at our Executive Committee this morning, and some of the people there started to sort of go on a rant a little bit about what's happening to the legislature with higher education and Head Start and community colleges. And I said to them, you know, let's get real about this. The reality of it is we have a system here through the personal kicker that keeps us from providing the investments that we need to make when we have those opportunities. And that puts all of you in a very bad box. And we're not saying at this point we want to do away with that. But we are saying it's time for Oregon to get serious about the fact what kind of revenue streams do you have? And within that limited revenue streams, we say this is one of the top priorities that you should fund. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lundquist. Questions? I have one for Ms. Ducker. In the Perry preschool study, do you remember if there was a cost-benefit ratio associated with that for every dollar invested in...
1 to 17.
Great. Thank you very much.
Sure. Mr. Chairman,
Senator Buck.
I wanted to make a comment as being one of the, I think, two legislators that were here, both for the Juvenile Crime Prevention Plan and the 99 and the Children's Plan and the 2001, which I think was fondly referred to as the triple nickel. Those bills would not have happened without the Crime Commission's incredible leadership, and I just want to say thank you. You guys did a tremendous job, and we appreciate you working on this issue as well. So,
thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Bedwell and Mr. Will.
Look at these guys. These are all my babies in my glasses. They're all babies.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields and the committee. On behalf of District Attorney Paul Beglow and myself, I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to be here today to address you. My name is Gary Will, and I'm speaking to you today not only as the Chief of Police for the City of Turner, but also as a member of Fight Crime Invest in Kids Oregon. Fight Crime Invest in Kids Oregon is a statewide, bipartisan, nonprofit anti-crime organization of 137 police chiefs, sheriffs, district attorneys, other law enforcement leaders, and violence survivors. It is part of a national organization of more than 3,000 law enforcement members. Mr. Beglow and I are members of Fight Crime Invest in Kids Oregon because we believe that investments in programs such as Healthy Start, Relief Nurseries, Head Start, and other high-quality early education programs are proven to give kids the right start in life and will cut crime. Today I'm here to talk specifically about the research that proves, in addition, all of its other benefits, Head Start cuts crime and saves money, and encourage you to provide an additional $39 million in funding to Oregon pre-kindergarten Head Start. Now, some of the research I'm going to talk about has already been briefly mentioned by the previous speakers, but I've also, as a police chief in Alaska for 4 years, we had Head Start on our island in our community, and we had no private preschools. And I saw what this research bears out before they did the research. You could tell the difference between the kids who had gone through Head Start and those who hadn't. So the research today that I'm going to talk about, there's two reports on Head Start released by Fight Crime Invest in Kids Oregon that showed that providing high-quality Head Start to all eligible at-risk Oregon children, we can prevent as many as 500 kids each and every year from becoming criminals when they grow up. And by providing this high-quality Head Start to all eligible at-risk Oregon children, the estimates show that Oregon will save approximately $500 million per year. Of that total, $300 million is in reduced government expenses and increased tax revenues. Fight Crime Invest in Kids cost savings report concludes that Oregon Head Start could get results in savings comparable to the Chicago Child Parent Center preschool, which had the $17 for every dollar invested return. The savings come from lower crime, reduced criminal justice expenses, less special education and welfare costs, plus increased tax revenue from higher earnings of adults who attended Head Start as kids. Another way to look at the savings is providing full Head Start funding to all eligible at-risk kids, we would cover half the costs of Oregon's prisons. With nearly 6,500 eligible 3- and 4-year-olds unable to access Head Start last year due to inadequate funding, our state cannot afford to ignore this need any longer. Research supports what my colleagues and I have known for many years. Head Start dramatically reduces crime. A national survey of Head Start graduates found that adults who attended Head Start as children were nearly 10% less likely to be arrested or charged with a crime than their siblings who did not attend Head Start. Fight Crime Invest in Oregon analyzed the research and found if Head Start was available to all of Oregon's at-risk 3- and 4-year-olds, our state could prevent 500 kids each year from growing up to be criminals. 500 kids every year avoiding crime will compound to thousands of prevented crimes and spared innocent victims, because we know that criminals don't just commit one crime. They tend to commit more than one. A landmark study of the high-scope Perry preschool and early education program similar to Head Start found incredible success in curbing future crime. At age 27, the participants who were left out of the program were 5 times more likely to have become chronic lawbreakers than kids who participated in the program. At the age of 40, the grown-up children who did not attend the Perry preschool program were four times more likely to have been arrested for drug felonies and nearly twice as likely to be arrested for violent multiple felonies. The City of Chicago's government-funded child parent centers found that by the age of 18, at-risk kids who were not in the program were 70% more likely than kids who attended to have been arrested for a violent crime. The child parent centers well prevented 33,000 crimes by the time the participants reached their 18th birthday. This program also cut child abuse and neglect of children in the program by half. This is incredibly important to law enforcement because study after study shows that kids who are abused and neglected are more likely to be arrested as juveniles than similar kids who are not abused or neglected. In February, the Senate Education and General Government Committee unanimously passed Senate Bill 46 and referred it to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. The bill proposes approximately $39 million in additional funds for the Oregon Pre-K Head Start program, and we urge you to support this proposal. With increased Head Start funds, Oregon will have kids succeeding in school, graduating from high school, and getting higher-paying jobs, which means they are more likely to give back to our communities rather than cost more in special education, welfare, and crime costs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Willem. Mr. Bedlow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Walt Beglaw. I'm the Marion County District Attorney. At this juncture, from what I heard, I feel like I'm in that pylon mode, so I'm going to do that for just a few minutes. Like the Chief, I believe that investments in child abuse and neglect prevention and intervention programs such as Healthy Start, relief nurseries like Family Building Blocks here in Marion County, and quality pre-kindergarten child care programs like Head Start are a necessary and compelling investment second to none. Last week I had the privilege of hearing Dr. Ross Thompson. I had never met him before. Author from Neurons to Neighborhoods and a professor of psychology at UC Davis, I believe, speak on the profound importance of brain development. We have learned, as you have heard, that 0 to 5 years of age is a critical point in time for healthy development and has truly far-reaching effects that reach our jobs in law enforcement and in prosecution. The most significant brain development occurs between birth to age 5. The kind of development and environment a child is exposed to in these particular years and the nurturing they receive, the touching, the rocking, the talking, the reading, and as Dr. Thompson spoke about, the social interaction that you'll see at a head start at age 3 and 4, or the eye-to-eye contact with a loving mother, brother, caretaker, determines, is the blueprint of what the development of that brain for the life of that child. In turn, that brain development determines and is a strong predictor of future behavior and productivity as a member of our communities. That was the very simple, strong message that he had. As Judge Abernathy, a juvenile judge here in our county, eloquently stated at our child abuse rally just a month ago, is nurture becomes nature. I tried to think of a great visual for myself, and what I came up with is that it's to make a tower, you have to build it one block at a time. And it's linear in my mind. So as district attorney, probably what brought me the greatest concern when he spoke last week is his research-based conclusion that children exposed to prolonged neglect face daunting challenges. And it actually, it frightened me. Because in Marion County, since 2005, we have rescued and taken into protective care over 2,100 children, primarily due to methamphetamine and prolonged neglect. So they have faced this horrible and inexcusable condition of neglect, filth, and often a home void of nurturing and love, quite frankly. And so we all of these kids. These are our kids. This is our challenge. But many of these kids face that we're encountering or in these programs don't face exactly what the neglect kids do, but they face other challenges through poverty, through vulnerability that is not their choice, quite frankly. So I guess regardless whether it's neglect or the circumstances of that particular child, failure to provide a healthy learning environment sets the child up for failure, and I see it every single day in my job. And it sets them up for failure in school if they get there, and it sets them up for a life of contact with Chief Will and Chief Moore behind me and myself. And we believe that programs like Head Start, and I've been out there and worked with them and seen the kids playing and learning, is really kind of that foundation of that tower, and it's an opportunity. So please join us in law enforcement. I'm here as district attorney in this investment for dollars because I think it's the right thing to do, and we really appreciate your time late in the day to listen about this very important community opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bevelick. Any questions? Well, we sure do appreciate you taking the time to prepare testimony to come and make this very important case before us. And I think that's one of the things that we've been impressed with on the public safety subcommittee all along is the willingness for the district attorneys to come forward and say, hey, it's not just about fighting crime, it's also about having a balanced approach throughout all of our public services as well as in law enforcement as well. So thank you very much for that testimony. Nice
thank
job.
You. Sure.
Just
doing the simple math, it seems to me as opposed to, you know, $40 million, if we put $120 million into this, we can put these guys out of a job.
Well, there's always politicians to investigate.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Duran and a few others, I believe.
Hello.
Welcome to the committee.
I'm Sharon Bowmeyer, and I work with Community Action Head Start in Washington County. And I work with the Early Head Start program. I'm here to speak about that. And this is Cindy Duran, who participated in our program. And she'll speak. I'll give you just a brief rundown about the Early Head Start program at Coffee Creek. You've heard information about Head Start from Ms. Burnham and information about brain development and the importance of early relationships and attachments from the district attorney. So before I start telling you about our program, Cindy brought an album that she put together when her children were with our program that we'd like to have you look at while we both speak. And the program at Coffee Creek began in 2002, and it was a program that was an outcome, I think, of the Children of Incarcerated Parents group. We serve 8 children, birth to 3. And the primary purpose of our program is to promote bonding and attachment between infants and toddlers. Currently, our program serves 5 infants who were born at Coffee Creek, and it's an incredible opportunity. It's an incredible privilege for the women to have the opportunity at our program to do this. Some of our moms are first-time moms who have minimal experience caring for their children, who have had limited experience or not very good experiences from their parents of modeling good parenting. And so while the moms are with us, they have this opportunity to care for their children. They're in charge of their children while we're there under the guidance and supervision of the teachers. The kids are there 2 days a week, 3.5 hours, and they're brought to us by the children's caregivers. Sometimes the Department of Human Services people have brought children to our program to participate. also, as Ms. Burnham mentioned, we work on the health and the social-emotional aspects of the children, as well as providing developmentally appropriate guidance to the moms who don't haven't necessarily had that modeling. And so while they care for their children, they interact with their children, and someone spoke about the importance of the direct eye contact and holding their babies, and that's the opportunity that we provide the children while they're with us. The other thing is that typically the moms enroll in the Parenting Inside Out program that's offered at Coffee Creek. That's the so that it's an intensive parenting program that the moms get to use that complements the time that they're with us. And so I urge you to invest in the Head Start program. Continue investment.
Thank you, Ms. Fummer. Ms. Duran, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Cindy Duran, and I am a single parent of 5 children, 4 of whom are at home. I'm also a recovering meth addict. I graduated from high school. After that, I worked for across the street at the Department of Insurance and Finance and was introduced to methamphetamine. That lasted for about 13 years. Eventually, I ended up being arrested at the Tiki Lodge in Salem after numerous prior arrests. That was my last arrest. And I had one of my sons with me. So they were taken into foster care, and I was taken to Marion County. I was sentenced to 3 years at Coffee Creek, and I was pregnant when I was sentenced. So I went in July, and then my baby was born in... So my last child was born in September, and he was taken into foster care the next day. Because of my 13 years of drug abuse, my mind was not really functioning clearly, probably for almost the first year and a half of my incarceration. During that time, I didn't have any visits with my son, the last one. He was in foster care. I started doing a parenting program, and then also was introduced to the Early Head Start program at Coffee Creek. I was doing this with my daughter. At this time, my DHS worker and DHS judge did start to order visits with my son, who was now 15 months old. The first time that I did see him was at Early Head Start, and we really worked on how that visit was going to take place so that it would be natural to him and it wasn't going to be scary for him, so that it was just a lot more comfortable. During my addiction, my active addiction, when I had my children with me, I had never really been parented. I didn't know how to parent. My idea of parenting was so distorted that for me, being a good parent was the fact that I had my children with me when I was using. I didn't go drop them off at daycare. I didn't go drop them off with a babysitter, anything like that. I took them with me on my drug runs. I took them with me to the store when I was shoplifting, so they were with me. That was my idea of being a parent. Once I started taking the classes and doing Early Head Start, I was given those tools about this is what it means to be a parent, and this is what your job is, and this is what your children's job is as children. And once I started to understand that and learn how to play with my children, that it was okay for me to get on the floor and play with my children and to participate in what they were doing, participate in their meal times, in their bath times, in scheduling appointments, and being involved with their doctors. My daughter did have to have a heart surgery when she was 2, and that was going to be up at Dornbecker's, and I was able to be involved with that from the institution. And that was very important. I had the opportunity there to practice all of those skills. And when I released, I've been out almost 4 years. I really wanted to continue with the program because my children, I felt, were getting a lot out of it, being more social and doing all the little songs and the dancing and just making friends there, which is something that we weren't used to doing in our family when I wasn't there. That wasn't something that that we did. There wasn't, I released to Marion County, and there was not an early Head Start program in Marion County. So, really think, I mean, everything just ended there as far as them being able to go to the school. What I did have was those was support still from the institution from Early Head Start for approximately, I would say, 6 months afterwards to where they would come and do home visits with me. I was living in an Oxford house and, you know, give me ideas. I really struggling financially. My children weren't living with me at that time, but struggling financially on, you know, when I had them on the weekends, what kind of activities could we do that didn't cost money? And so they would bring me marbles. They would bring me a shoebox with some paint in it and, you know, do the marbles inside the shoebox and put those up on the wall. And those were just activities that my children enjoyed doing with me, because no longer was it what could I buy them to make up for it for me being gone. It was they just wanted me there and to be consistent with them. And that was just huge for me. Once I was off parole in Marion County, I ended up moving to Wilsonville. My youngest son misses the deadline for kindergarten by 14 days. So we looked for a Head Start program. The closest one was in Oregon City, and they didn't come out to Wilsonville to pick up the kids. So once again, he was going to miss another year of Head Start. So he goes to a babysitter. I wasn't able to provide transportation. Like I said, I'm a single mom. I work full-time in St. John's at the Center for Family Success. I'm a parent advocate, so I work with other women now who are coming out of the institution or who are on parole and probation, who their children are in foster care. The same thing I really think that I got from Early Head Start and from parenting is what I do now for the same women, because I know what helped me and I know what the children need. And one of the really big plans that we work on, I also case manage the Success House in St. John's, which is Clean and Sober Housing. And part of their plan, if their children are at that age, is to get them enrolled in Early Head Start or Head Start. That's one of the first referrals that we'll make when the kids do come home. You know, what another big thing that we've done is learn how to advocate for our children. And that also started when I was at Early Head Start. And, I mean, today's been a busy day for me, because I've a little over 6 years clean and sober now. I've been out almost 4 years. And I've been advocating the whole time to be able to be involved with my children at school. I mean, I was allowed to go to conferences and some things like that, but I could never go on a field trip. I could never be a volunteer in the classroom. You know, I've gone to principals, I've gone to the school board, I've done all those things. And finally, 2 weeks ago, I finally got approved. So I've been on a field trip all day long with my son, which was really cool. And they told me I was like the best chaperone ever. The kids did, the parents, the teachers did. The kids told me I was the best chaperone ever. So it was just a really great day, and my kids just really appreciate it. And they know that I worked hard to, I don't think it wasn't so much for me, but it was for them, because they have that, they have that right to have their parent there and to be involved in their activities. I mean, they work hard in school. My son has not missed a day of school. He's working hard for a perfect attendance. The only day that he did miss, and he advocated for himself, was for children of incarcerated parents to stay here at the legislature. And he had to go back, take the plate, show it, do a report. So they're just like any other kid. So I really support these programs, Early Head Start, Head Start, and appreciate your support also.
Great. Thank you very much. Did a great job. Very nice testimony. Any questions?
Sure.
Representative Cameron.
Cindy, good to see you again. Thanks for coming and sharing your story. Where was the field trip to?
Aurora Colony, the historic farms.
All right.
Good. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here.
Mr. Ann, you brought up an interesting topic about Oxford houses and recovery homes. I was just curious, were you able to go straight from Coffee Creek into an Oxford house, or did you have some time in between?
I had nowhere to release to. I had a mentor, and we just showed up at the door on Market Street and said, I need to get in here, begged to get in there. They put me on an emergency bed, and then so I was able to stay there.
And my experience with Oxford House is they don't just take anybody, but you have to advocate for yourself. You have to sell that,
exactly.
Make the case to the other residents that you're a good good risk for their sobriety. Was that the situation?
That was exactly the situation. And I didn't want to go because as we drove over to the Oxford House, my mentor, who works for Bridgeway, called there to set up an appointment. The person that answered was someone who I had been incarcerated with, who we did not like each other whatsoever. There was 3 times I almost got in trouble at Coffee Creek, and it was with her, and she was the president of the house, so I really had to advocate to get in there. But she, you know, had been living there and had made changes as far as her cognitive thinking also. So yeah, definitely had to advocate because I had just come out, didn't have any money to pay rent, didn't have a job, didn't have anything.
One thing that the way Oxford houses work, if you're not familiar, is that residents can give you a UA on demand pretty much and kick you out instantly if they think that you're using it. And some people have been concerned that that violates landlord-tenant law and people's abilities to have a fair day in court. But it always seems to me that if you're threatening somebody else's sobriety, that's part of what you sign up for when you enter an Oxford house. Would you agree that people should be able to be kicked out instantly if they're using in this
situation?
Exactly.
That's also how I run our success house.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I object. That's a leading question. Holy smokes.
But yes, definitely.
Yeah. Because there, we heard in the full Ways and Means on the Road a lot about recovery homes, and and I think there's a proposal in the DHS budget to add a couple of more. And I just, I think of, we probably have, 120 recovery homes in Marion and Multnomah counties, but, what is the person in Lakeview do when they're trying to get clean and sober and they have nowhere to go for clean and sober housing or in other parts of the state? So thank you for that perspective. Representative Barker.
Thank you. And I want to really give you a special thanks for participating, going on, helping others coming out, because people who haven't been what you've been through don't have the credibility, as you would know, for somebody coming out of prison. They need, you can tell them, because you know what it's like. I wouldn't have a clue, and you do, and I really appreciate you to making that extra step in your life. You're probably helping countless others. Thank you.
Well said. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You did a very nice job. We're now going to go into the public testimony, and we've got until 7:30. We've got 5 people signed up. Does anybody want to testify that is not signed up at this point? So that would be 6. And so if we could try to keep 6 or 7, try to keep your testimony maybe around 4 or 5 minutes, we should be able to give everybody a chance. Why don't I bring up the person who traveled furthest first? That would be Doug Lochtal, who came from Southern Oregon to tell his story about Head Start. If you could please come on up.
Hello, my name is Doug Lochtal. I'm a teacher at Southern Oregon Head Start, and I got this invitation through our local, through AFSCME, and I'm here, I guess, there's been a lot of statistics and very powerful testimony, so I feel what I could add is maybe some insight into what it looks like inside a classroom at Head Start and how we, what we do and how we serve these children. So, and I also want to thank you, Representative Shields, for calling my boss and making sure I could get here today.
what you do on your own time is your business.
Yeah, exactly. So that was nice. Thank you, though. The way we work, basically, at the beginning of the year, we get our list, the kids we have. We go over their histories, and we meet the families. And it can be a very heart-wrenching experience to get the histories of these kids. And I have some statistics here also. We serve 920 children in our program. We have a large Head Start, and these are statistics from last year. We had, out of that, a number, 137 family members have been incarcerated or on parole within the last 3 years out of 920 kids. We have had 250 mothers and 214 fathers who had not obtained a high school diploma. And 109 families were homeless at some time during the school year out of 920 kids. So 88 children were in foster care out of this 920. And what I can say out of my class is what that looks like in my class. I have 19 kids in my class. This year I have 4 children who have at least one parent who are in prison currently right now. I've got 6 other kids whose parents have been in the system. They're currently on probation or now. So that's over half my class have parents who are involved in the criminal justice system. Last year I had almost half my class that had been in foster care or were currently in foster care. I have a child this year who was found on the streets of Medford at 2 o'clock in the morning in diapers, 2 years old, went into foster care. I had her brother last year who was found with her, and that was a very angry boy. And I've had 2 kids this year in my class that were found in a hotel room, no one there, eating out of the trash. They had been there for 2 days. This is the reality of the children we are serving. That, from hearing this, you can tell these are kids that are at very high risk. And they're very angry, and they have an issue with authority. So what it looks like in the classroom, what we do is, first of all, we provide a safe environment for them, and that speaking to the brain research, it's what happens with a child that has undergone trauma and has been under stress and trauma their whole life. Their resting state, their regular state of brain operation is in that fight or flight response. They're operating out of their stem, the brain stem. And when children are in that, they're not going to hear any of the other academic, cognitive stuff. It's not going to happen. They're worried about safety. So what I do is we provide a safe environment, calm environment, where they can get out of that state and into a calm state where they're able to use the logical part of their brain, the part that deals with language, the cortex. And from there, our class is centered around social skills and social and emotional skills. And I feel that this is really the crux of the deal with keeping kids out of the criminal justice system, because what we teach is conflict resolution and how to problem solve, and that is our priority in the classroom. That, and it applies, and a grown-up, when they're going to break the law, it's a choice. There's something they want to do, the limit is there, they're not allowed to do it, they make a choice, they are not able to handle that conflict. What we teach is for them to be able to problem solve that and to deal with their emotions. When they're angry, what can they do? In my room, I have an angry area, I have a sad area. The kids learn to be able to say, to feel, how are they feeling right now? What? I'm angry. By the end of the year, I expect my children to be able, when they have a conflict, if they're angry, they go to the angry area by themselves. They walk over there, we have clay for them to pound, dolls for them to play with, newspaper to rip, different things. If a certain kid is interested into a certain thing, I have a child this year who's a master builder, and he's had a rough life. Both his parents are in prison right now. He's in foster care. He can have explosive anger. Something will trigger him, and he'll explode. Now he's able to go over. He has a special desk with Legos. Walk over there. What this teaches the kids is to have control over their choices, to be able to, how are they feeling? What can they do about it? And when they're upset and sad, they go to the sad area. There's pillows. They can go over there and cry. They're able to take control and act appropriate action when they're with their emotions. The other big piece is we teach conflict resolution. And when kids have conflict with each other, what can they do? And we teach them to solve that conflict on their own. And again, by the end of the year, I expect my children that if they're having a conflict, that I can say to them, it looks like you need to problem solve. What are you guys going to do about this? and the majority of them by the end of the year can do that. We have a process they go through. They each get their turn to speak. They get to say what happened. And, of course, with children, it's usually, you know, completely different stories of what happened. They have a hard time of ascertaining motives of other children, and we also try to teach to that. But they are able to each have to say their piece. What happened? How are they feeling when that happened? And then, what could they look like differently? So they learn how to, you know, assess the problem and the solution. They then have to negotiate that solution with each other and agree what is the solution, and then they carry it out. And what we do is we practice and say, okay, what happened at this situation last time? This. You guys agreed on the solution, we're going to do it again. We go right there and they practice it, because everyone knows that with 3 to 5 year old kids, if you just say, I expect next time for you to, you know, share with this kid, or it's not, you know, it doesn't enter in the brain.
Shalapta, you're doing a great job. I'm on literally on the edge of my seat with your testimony, but we do have several others who are coming, okay. So maybe 30 seconds if you could go.
All right.
Thanks.
So what we do is we teach skills, and I feel that those skills are beneficial in the long term, and that they can get it now when their brain is plastic and forming. We give them the repetition, and it becomes ingrained, and it's a habit and a way of thinking that we give to these children, and that is how we get that 35% less involvement. That's what happens.
That's fantastic. You're obviously incredibly dedicated, and we really appreciate your work for those kids who have so many challenges to overcome. Any questions?
Just get them to cover the House of Representatives for a few
minutes. Yeah, we can use a little clay.
Anything I can do, I will do it. Absolutely.
Thank you very much, particularly for driving all this way to share your perspective. Much appreciated.
Thanks for the opportunity.
You're welcome. Ms. Herms? Ms. Miller and Jerry Moore.
Mr. Sheridan,
yes. Education that he has.
Could we
do that?
Hear a little bit about your qualifications, your background, your education?
Yeah.
Left off? Yeah.
My background is that...
Can you come up to the mic?
Just come to the mic real quick.
In fact, if you want a couple of my minutes, you can.
Well, my background, my education, I have a bachelor's degree in a totally unrelated field, creative writing. But I then went back to school to take some early childhood education units. I've done a lot of self-educating. I'm really into brain research. Dr. Perry, I don't know if some of you guys have bumped into his research. He's at the forefront of neurobiology and how the children's brain works. So I've delved into that. I ended up at Head Start just because somehow I ended up always basically doing free daycare wherever I lived. All the kids in the neighborhood end up coming over to my house somehow. And so I thought I should, you know, do that. I love it. It's the most rewarding job I could ever imagine. And once I got into Head Start, what I saw with these kids, I mean, like I say, we get the list of kids at the beginning of the year. It's a heartbreaking history we hear from these children. And so I feel my responsibility is to do whatever I can for these children. And I've seen the enormous impact it can have on children. And my own son was a student at Head Start, and that's where I found him. We adopted we just finished our adoption 2 weeks ago. It was final. Mm-hmm. And I saw him go from a kid who was growling at adults and no trust whatsoever. He was he didn't gain a pound, grow an inch, learn anything for a long time. He was in a very traumatic situation, and he went to Head Start for 2 years, and he's reading, he's in kindergarten, he's a success story, and I see that, and I want to see that happen for more children.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Ready when you are. Welcome to the committee.
Act to follow, sir.
Yeah.
Hi. Thank you for allowing me a few minutes here to speak tonight. My name is Noetta Herms, Chair Shields, committee members. Thank you. You know, I had a two-page, two-minute speech here, but many of the points have been touched on, and I guess I'm feeling a little inspired here, so I'll try and stay on task. But reflecting back on my own childhood, I came from a pretty challenging family, nothing like what I was just hearing about, but feeling pretty disconnected when I went to school as a teacher in Portland Public Schools Head Start system. That's one of my goals, is to bring the children and their families in to feel connected, you know, ultimately to avoid involvement with gangs and whatnot, but primarily to feel supported, that the schools, the community servants participate in our education programs, all friends and family. So that's just a little bit of background. I am a licensed teacher, as I said, for Portland Public Schools. We serve 620 children in the Portland area. I currently have two groups of students. About 35% of my children are English language learners. About 30% are special needs children. So that's pretty high for classrooms across the state. As a Head Start teacher and parent, I've seen the broad-reaching effects of education on our young children. I know from 23 years of working with children of all ages that when children are involved in productive activities, they have less of an inclination to cause mischief. Of course, this holds true with extensive research on the benefits of high-quality, effective pre-kindergarten programs, too. Head Start leads the way nationally, and Head Start was first implemented nationally in 1965 in Oregon's Portland Public Schools. We started up in 1967, so there's quite a long history there. Head Start provides comprehensive services to low-income, special needs, English language learning children and their families. We include high-quality preschool education, health, nutrition, social-emotional skill development, and services to families, including parent training, as you've well heard. Research from the National Head Start Association is reflected in multiple independent studies. This extensive research shows that our Head Start programs provide educational, economic, health, and law enforcement benefits. One of my very favorite studies as I was doing research to speak tonight, we've actually heard some of this, the exact same statistics from, and that is the Fight Crime, Invest in Kids study. Let's see what they speak of there. This 2004 longitudinal study of more than 600 Head Start graduates show that Head Start benefits our society by increased earnings, employment, and family stability, less dependency on welfare, lower crime costs, greater repetitions in school, and lower needs for special needs children. So in my research, I've seen where it shows a $9 benefit for every $1 invested in Head Start. I was quite excited to hear of other studies that have quoted a $17 for every $1 investment. So we can look even closer to home. There are clear effects that even within the same household, Head Start benefits our families. According to the report from Fight Crime, Invest in Kids in Oregon, and other large national surveys have found that Head Start graduates are 8.5% less likely to be arrested later or to have been charged with a crime than their siblings who have not attended Head Start. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, in Oregon, we've had 180,750 crimes committed in 2003, including 10,520 that are violent crimes. Over 30,000 juveniles are arrested every year in Oregon. Head Start can help to reduce these crimes before they happen, but not after. Everyone benefits when our children are provided with high-quality pre-kindergarten opportunities. We can cut crime and reduce drug abuse across our society. And with all of these benefits, according to the Oregon Department of Education in 2005, we are still only serving 40% of our eligible Oregon children. That works out to be about 6,400 children, as we've heard earlier, that are not receiving quality pre-kindergarten experiences. We do need to fully fund our high-quality Head Start program and prevent as many as 500 children a year from becoming future criminals. Thank you for your time and for this opportunity to speak tonight.
Thank you, Ms. Hermes. Good testimony. Ms. Miller, I presume?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Sue Miller. I'm the Executive Director of Family Building Blocks, which is the relief nursery serving Marion and Polk counties. And I want to thank you for recognizing the relationship between the work of early childhood programs and crime prevention. It's very, very exciting to see that the partnership is really building in the state of Oregon. There are 9 relief nurseries in the state. We have a sort of informal association, and our association is strongly supportive of the full funding for the Head Start program. Many of our children, we take children from 6 weeks to 5 years old. Many of the children who start with us when they're infants graduate from a relief nursery and go to Head Start. So I'm always calling up Jody Burnham in the fall saying, oh, can you find a few more spaces, because we've got a few more children ready to leave our more intensive services, but definitely still needing the strong wraparound services of Head Start. So we are definitely partners in this work together. The matrix that I believe you just received on the yellow paper, that was actually put together for relief nurseries a few years ago, actually for another legislative hearing. But I wanted to offer it just as an example of the system of care that you've heard about tonight also. And in that matrix, you'll see Head Start, Healthy Start over in the prevention area. You've got relief nurseries trying to do some prevention as well as intervention. And then if we aren't successful, or if kids haven't gotten our services, you end up in the very intensive, very expensive services, including corrections, over on the right-hand side. One last piece. We started being a part of a drug court a year ago, our relief nursery did. It's called Fostering Attachment Dependency Court that Judge Pamela Abernathy here in Marion County started. It's for parents who have been arrested for doing meth, have young children under the age of 5, and obviously when the parents get arrested, the kids are taken into foster care. So when the parents show up at Judge Abernathy's courtroom, she gives them, if they meet our criteria, she gives them the option of participating in our drug court, which means they come to our relief nursery, they get, you know, drug and alcohol treatment and also mental health support, all sorts of wraparound services. And of the 8 graduates we've had in the last year, needless to say, it's a pretty small, very intensive program. All 8 of those graduates have been reunified with their children. So they're out of the foster care system. They've been released from DHS, so they're off of that part of the state system. And at graduation, Judge Abernathy asks the parents, so what was the primary motivator for you to stay clean? And in every one of those cases, it was getting their babies back. So we are all in this together, and I think our success will help you all be successful in reducing your budgets in the future and saving more lives. Thank you very much.
Well said, Ms. Miller. Thank you for coming to testify. Mr. Moore.
Good evening, Chair Shields and Senators and Representatives. My name is Jerry Moore. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Salem. I'm also a proud member of the Family Building Blocks Board of Directors. I want to give you a little taste of reality this evening. Every morning I get a morning report of significant events that might have taken place the day before. And as you can imagine, in a city the size of Salem, it's pretty lengthy on occasion. But I'd like to read one to you that just came across my desk the other day. About 11:30 in the evening, officers were sent on a welfare check. Upon arrival, I found the house in utter disaster. There were cockroaches on the ground. There was a heavy smell of cat urine and feces. There were about 8 full litter boxes. The floor was covered in garbage. The home had little food inside. There was also a child. 2.5 years ago, our agency created what we call our Drug Activity Response Team. In 2.5 years, this team, whose job is to investigate drug houses, has actually investigated over 1,700 reported drug houses just in Salem. Now, not all of them reach the level of what I just described to you, but what I can tell you is during the course of those investigations, what Dick Mel refers to as the unintended consequences, of the 2,100 children that the district attorney discussed taken into protective custody, this four-man team has taken 846 of them into protective custody. They've also deemed 63 homes as unfit for human habitation. Now, I'm going to guess that most of you have never been in a drug house or a meth house, but I have. I've felt it. I've smelt it. I've walked through it. I've seen what it amounts to, and because of the conditions, I almost feel like sometimes I've tasted it. And if you've never walked through one, I just want to give you a little piece of what these children live in. When near the home, there's dogs and cats running free. Obviously, never go outside. There's animal waste on the floor. There's garbage. There's dirty clothes. As you progress into the kitchen, there isn't a clean dish in the kitchen. The kitchen counter and the sink are full of terribly dirty dishes, many with food on them, a lot of it rotten. There's animals jumping onto the counter. If you open the refrigerator, there's very little food, and what is in there may be rotten. There's cockroaches and bugs. If you go to the restroom, you'll find maybe the toilet works. I guarantee you the shower or the bathtub will be dripping. It'll be stained to the condition where you wouldn't want to get in it. And when you go into their little children's bedrooms, most often it's a urine-stained mattress. There's no sheets. There might be a dirty blanket. And those are the types of conditions that these children live in. Now, in 30 years of law enforcement, I can tell you that I'm the chief now, but years ago I used to be a real cop. And when I did that, I probably served approximately 300 search warrants during my time. And I've seen it, and I remember walking into those homes and saying to the other officers, this kid doesn't have a chance. This kid doesn't have a chance because they don't know any different. That's how they're raised, and that's what they think is the norm. Well, as I listen today to the encouraging stories from a variety of people, I do believe that the kids do have a chance. I've told so many times that there's many types of crime prevention, but I think family building blocks and Head Start programs like that are the best crime prevention programs we have. They give kids a fighting chance. They let kids know that there's somebody that cares about them, that loves them, and it helps them develop and be get proper nutrition and some of the other things they need. And it also touches the parents. You know, I talk about parents in name only sometimes because they really aren't parents. They don't know how to be a parent. And I think many of these programs also give parents the opportunity to learn the skills and responsibilities that they have as parents to these children. And one thing I have learned is that how a child is raised is a good reflection of how they're going to act as an adult. And quite honestly, many of these children, as I say, don't have a chance because unless we get to them early, we're going to get to them later. And we can rescue them when they're young, but we can't provide the service that many of these agencies can. So I encourage you to support Head Start and many of the relief nurseries and other agencies such as that because I really do believe it has a huge, great investment in our future. Thanks.
Very well said. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it. Next up, Ms. Groves and Ms. Bosch. And perhaps Ms. Elliott as well.
It's been a long way tonight. I went out
all the time. Oops. Was somebody there to greet you and direct you back, hopefully?
Yes.
Good. Our apologies for that.
Okay.
Things that were almost beyond our control.
I'm happy to be here. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jana Bush. I am a member of the Partnership for Safety and Justice. We appreciate your efforts to broaden the debate on public safety, to talk about early intervention programs such as Head Start. It's critical that we find children who are at risk early and take positive steps to influence their lives. I've been in a Head Start classroom just as a librarian, and I was so impressed with the orderliness and how smart the children were. I'm very concerned about the decline in previous sessions in program funding for the Department of Corrections, cuts to drug and alcohol treatment, adult basic education, and juvenile intervention programs reduced the state's ability to maintain public safety. We are pleased that some improvements are taking place this session, but we urge you to do more, particularly in the areas of drug and alcohol treatment and cognitive behavior training. Oregon has the third fastest growing prison system in the country. The budget has tripled in the last 12 years. We spend more general fund dollars on the prison system, which warehouses 3,400 prisoners, than we do on higher education, which benefits 438,000 Oregon students. It is time for a more effective and physically responsible approach to public safety, an approach that focuses on reducing future crime and stopping the growth of our prison system. If Oregon shifts its public safety strategy away from its massive prison buildup to warehouse people, we can not only make advances in crime reduction, but also save valuable taxpayer dollars to invest in health care, programs like Head Start, K-12 education, and our colleges and universities. Oregon's next prison will cost over $600 million. Adding that to the state's credit card won't help our future. In fact, it will force us to take money away from other needed programs while we pay back an additional $30 to $40 million general fund dollars per biennium for the next 20 years. I would like to thank Senators Brown and Nelson and Representatives Hannah, Shields, and Nathanson for their support of Senate Bill 856, the Partnership for Safety and Justice strongly supports your Senate bill to create a smart on crime task force as a way to reduce Oregon's prison population safely with wise investments in programs. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Groves. Ms. Bosch. Did I switch them?
I'm Bosch.
Okay, my apologies.
I'm Ms. Groves. Just to add to that, and thank you for hearing our testimony today also, and for sponsoring this bill.
Could you just identify yourself one more time for the rest?
Sure, sorry. Kaya Groves, and I'm a member of the Partnership for Safety and Justice as well. And I would just like to add to her testimony as far as the side of a taxpaying citizen as well, that I'm very concerned with the numbers I've seen also for all of the prisons going up and the children that are not being served in relation to that. Living in Oregon, I want my child to grow up with the programs and that, and I'm seeing also inside of the prisons that they do not have the programs that they need to benefit the parents of the children that are having to pay for all this too. And sorry, I don't have a prepared testimony, but I'm scared of these numbers of prisons that are going up, and I want to live in a safe community as well, but I think warehousing is not the answer to this. And I just would absolutely encourage your creating a smart on crime task force. Thank you.
Well done, Ms. Gross. Thank you very much for your testimony. Ms. Elliott.
My name is Ann Elliott, and I come to speak to you as a parent without any degrees, but with the experience of having grown up without the example of quality parenting to draw on. For those of you who are parents, you know that parenting is, in fact, the most difficult job most of us will ever have in our lives, but it's also the most important. I have two children who send me here with high recommendations tonight. They're 25 and 27, and they often say to me, I don't know how you did such a good job when you didn't have good parenting experiences to draw from. And the way that I did that was through my preschool experience with them, of learning parenting skills while my children were very young. And although that happened through a private preschool program here in Salem, what I am here to say to you is that it's not just for the children that these programs are so important. Our children are preschoolers for a few short years, but we are parents forever, and continue to assist them in their life's journey, hopefully not in the Justice Department or Family Welfare Services, but in being productive, contributing citizens for our country. So I sent my children to a private college on the East Coast, which cost me all of my retirement funds, but the most important educational dollars I ever spent were on their preschool experience. It cannot be made up later. Later, they might be able to put themselves through college, but they can't put themselves through preschool. And if parents don't have the resources to do that for them, then it is in our interest as citizens of this community to provide that for the people who will be handing out the pills in our nursing home, sitting on the bench at our justice system. We all have a connection to providing for these children in ways that we can't do after they're 5 years old. It's critical that we do it in these early years for the children and for the parents. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for this panel?
Well, just a comment.
Senator Wesley.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for your testimony. What I think you emphasized and highlighted is the what I consider the frosting on the cake part of this type of program and early involvement with children in their development. And we hear the horrific stories, which are just that, horrific stories. And those individuals are certainly in most need of these services. But what so often gets left out of the equation is just what you were alluding to, is these children that would have, for whatever reason, their own volition, you know, luck, pluck, or circumstance, would have, quote, made it anyway. You know, they would have graduated from high school. You know, okay, systems work. I mean, a student went through and a C-plus student or whatever. With these services, you know, that individual benefits just so much more. This successful student would have benefited just that much more, would have graduated with that much more capacity, you know, to do good or start a business. So that's the unspoken of benefit to these type programs, and all of them. I mean, all of the early intervention, the relief nurseries, I'm so glad that was brought up in Head Start. There's much more to this than just getting those children that are in desperate straits. There's the component, and it's an important one, of how we increase the learning capacity, you know, the capacity to feel and love of children that otherwise would have been deemed, you know, successful children, successful students. It's a very important part to all of this.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming to testify. And last, Dana Heppert.
Good evening, Chair Shields and members of the committee. I'll be really brief and hopefully relevant because I don't want you to spend your dinner hour listening to lobbyists. But I did want to come and speak not as a lobbyist, although Stand for Children has made this one of our top legislative priorities, full funding of Head Start, but more as a former third grade teacher who saw these kids just a few years later. In my third grade class in Milwaukee, I had 21 kids, 10 really struggled with reading, and two of my third graders at 9 years old did not know the sounds of all 26 letters in the alphabet. And the one thing I want to add to this incredibly relevant and important conversation is that Head Start does one other thing that I think is critical to future crime prevention, which is that it gets kids ready to learn how to read. And 83% of kids who leave Head Start with more skills than these two 9-year-old boys in my third grade classroom. And I think that's all I'm going to say about it, but just thank you for having this conversation. Oh, one more thing that I think is relevant is that some states use third grade reading scores to predict future prison capacity needs. You're nodding your head. I'm sure you've heard this before. So just to close the link on that connection there, this is so incredibly
such an incredibly important program. Thank you.
Well said. Thank you very much. Any closing comments, colleagues? Well, we've got some important decisions to make in the Ways and Means process over the next couple of weeks, and I hope that we'll begin to think more broadly about what should and should not be part of the public safety budget as we move through this in the coming days. So thank you all for coming and testifying and spending your evening with us. We, again, apologize that we had to move at the last moment, but as we get into this part of the session, those type of things do happen, and we appreciate your willingness to work with us. This meeting,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I especially apologize for Chief Will because he was really looking forward not having to drive to Salem, I'm sure.
Senator Westland.
I apologize for not making this comment before you did your closing remarks, but this is the way you're asking for money. It's the Ways and Means Committee. That's the totally appropriate place to do that, and we are addressing this need in, you know, our current budget climate. And you know, the great news is that, you know, there is a great deal of you know, synergy around this issue, as we call it up here. It's got legs. Okay, that doesn't. We don't know what level we can fund it at. There's still a lot of big decisions to be made. There's still the May revenue forecast. There's a lot of variables out there that we don't have control over, that nobody really knows the answer to yet. But I just want to make this comment as we all go forward. Well, what you were really saying in many ways is, you know, we've got to reform the way we look at, you know, this eventual end of cycle warehousing and incarceration model that we're also dependent on. You know, it's a fundamental reform of how we approach what we're currently doing. I would also suggest that as we go forward, and you passionate advocates, look at how this state raises revenue. We need fundamental revenue fiscal reform. I've been in Ways and Means my entire legislative career, and every session, the back of my back of the envelope number gets bigger. You know, what's that number? It's the structural deficit built into these budgets every biennium. And this biennium, it's $1.6 billion. Let me put this in perspective in terms of not just the most volatile revenue structure in America, which we certainly are. Think of it this way. Think of it as if we took Idaho's tax structure, that bastion of liberal thought. We took Idaho's tax structure, moved it, you know, a couple hundred miles west, dropped it on Oregon, we would produce an additional $1.2 billion of biennium. That's Idaho's tax structure. And we wonder why we fund judges at 50th lowest in the nation and community colleges at 43rd. It's because our tax structure is 47th lowest in the nation. So until we do muster the political courage, and that's just not us up here, that's you out there, muster the political courage to address the fundamental structural deficits and the instability, not just the adequacy, but the stability function of these budgets, we will continue, you know, to fight for ever-shrinking pieces of an ever-shrinking pie. Oregon is in serious trouble. And you were here, you know, a call to action. And I cannot tell you how much I appreciate all of you being here. But we've got to become frontline advocates for much more than just this program or this program, because so many of them are vital and critical. We need fundamental systemic fiscal reform. I apologize for editorializing, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your comments, Senator Westland. This meeting is adjourned.